Are you gay?
Geeky?
Just enjoy hearing your good Judy's dish about the latest in pop culture?
Well, then you're in luck.
The boys of Flame On are here for you.
In every episode, we discuss the topics that entrance us.
Whether it's comics, TV,
movies,
drag queens,
or video games,
we've got you covered.
So, if you're ready for your gay and geeky slice of pop culture life,
then sit back and get ready to
Flame On!
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello?
Look, I'm going to level with you. I have my own things to deal with. After all, we are about to have a lovely landing.
The Orphans, an original cinematic audio drama, is now available. And now, The Orphans Facility, an exciting new prequel series. Catch up with Season 1 with new episodes of Facility coming bi-weekly.
Flame On is presented by the Nerdy Show Network, geeky programming for all nerds across the multiverse. All Nerdy Show programming is made possible by A Comic Shop, Orlando's number one comic shop and nerd destination, and with the generous support of listeners like you. To learn how you can support this and other fine geeky programming, visit nerdyshow.com.
Welcome to Flame On. My name is Pat. I'm your talking bearskin rug, and we are back with another deep dive episode for you. I am sitting in the host chair today, being joined by Brian.
Hello.
Because today's topic is one that is very near and dear to Brian's heart, and I didn't know much about it, so I figured what better way to bring this conversation to life than me being the one to really ask a lot of questions, because
oh, great.
I didn't know much about this.
I didn't study.
Oh, it's all right.
I have my books, though.
All right. So, we are talking today, if you did not read the title of this episode, about Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events. This is a 13-book series written by Daniel Handler under the pen name of Lemony Snicket that has been brought very successfully to Netflix. And season 2 just recently dropped, and we have now seen both of the first two seasons, and we are here to talk about it. So, Brian, tell me about how this book series came into your life. Back all the way, at least in 1999, maybe later than that, when did you start reading these books?
I don't actually remember. I was digging through my archive, my library, which I have, trying to find these books, and they're buried, of course, double stacked. You have too many books for a bookcase. And I found them, and I was looking through one of the books called The Beatrice Letters, and I saw a copyright of 2006, which meant that that book, I believe, came out towards the end of the time I was reading it, because I was reading the series while they were being released, and I think I was in, may have been in grad school, may have been just out of college. So I'm going to say mid-2000s, and that sort of lines up with the different trademarks, but I don't remember starting like right away. And it was literally like just by fate. I think I had read Harry Potter. Well, I should say I started with the Golden Compass series, His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman, which is another one of my favorite YA books. And perusing the bookstore back then, Borders, Barnes & Noble, the usual, I encountered these books very early in that discovery, like Harry Potter and all that stuff. So, yeah, Lemony Snicket, Series of Unfortunate Events. It is YA. It is sort of young adult. But what I always loved about this series And what I think I kept coming back for was it's very much the C.S. Lewis kind of like trying to sort of teach as it's telling you a story. And so a lot of times in the books and in the adaptation, you'll have, you know, they'll say a word, adversity, and then they'll say, by which we mean struggle, which is very fine. And, you know, it's kind of a classic. They didn't invent this technique for these books. But what they do that's really fun as the books progress, and I think we've seen this a little bit in the series so far somewhat, is they almost find sort of a bit of a sarcastic bite sometimes, and almost not perverse, but they subvert some of the meanings a little bit to work into the story that they're telling and to tell kind of a moral parable or in some cases a satirical turn. I think the hospital episode is where you really start, or no, the Vile Village, I think, is one of the ones where you really start to say. Anyway, all this being said, I was definitely sort of young adult, not YA, unfortunately. Because YA, young adult literature, is meant for like kids. It's not really young adult, right? It's they call it YA, but it's.
I think that really kind of stretches into, you know, into the teen years and whatnot. Which I mean, I get that when you were reading these, that wasn't exactly the target demographic they were going for. But I mean, it's a series that, in watching it come to life, I haven't read the books myself. Although now I'm kind of eager to see what these last four books have in store, considering how crazy all of the events have been going through these first books that have been done in seasons one and two. But I think it's something that kind of reaches an audience that isn't just your, you know, 10, 12, 14, 16-year-old reader, that it definitely can give a bit of a life lesson for people a bit older.
So, you know, again, like, this is an interesting genre, which there's been a lot of amazing stuff written. And obviously, in the last, what, 7 or 8 years, I think, with the Hunger Games after Harry Potter, like, the movieization, the realization of these books as movies has really taken off, become its own genre in movies. And the interesting thing with this particular series is they tried to do this as a movie. And I think it was back, like, you know, let's say 10 years ago with Jim Carrey, very famously. And that movie was actually really good. I liked it. It, to me, captured the spirit of the first three books with some departures and some embellishments, which I was fine with. The music is one of my favorite soundtracks. The acting was fabulous. The tone was really close to what I remembered loving about the book series. But unfortunately, it didn't do very well in the box office. So they didn't make any more of the books, of which, like you said, there are 13, and we only got three. What I learned about, and I was actually just reminding myself of, is some of the production people from the movie actually left the project early on because of creative differences, including Daniel Handler and Barry Sonnenfeld, who, if you're familiar with, like, Pushing Daisies and, oh gosh, Men in Black, I think. Like, he has a very Addams Family. I may be totally wrong on some of these, but he has a very unique, austere sort of just-so sensibility, and not Daniel Handler, Brian Fuller borrows a lot from this sort of same palette in his shows. So I've always been attracted to this, and what this Netflix series is Handler, Daniel Handler, and Sonnenfeld, and some other people from that movie production, but the ones who left, getting a chance to really tell their version of the Unfortunate Events series. And since Handler is the writer, I also feel like he's getting a chance to sort of have a second draft of this, sort of. Like, I'm sure he did multiple drafts, but getting a chance to sort of tell the story in a way that is adapted for television or Netflix television, and also get some of the more mysterious elements and some of the more, you know, little MacGuffins or red herrings even out there earlier, so you keep being interested in the mystery that, and it propels you through the series. Because one of the things, the book, like the books, it takes a while before you get answers. And there are many people who, you know, I don't want to spoil anything, but don't necessarily find the series to have all the answers in it. But yeah, I mean, I'm especially with season two. Season one, a little bit, but season two, it spoon fed out a lot of the mysteries in a way that I felt was very satisfying.
Yeah. I mean, with not knowing much of the story or any of the story going into either season two definitely keeps you interested and is able to kind of pique your interest in the whole storyline and with some great acting as well. And just to touch back, it's actually been almost 14 years since the movie, 2004.
Wow. So I must have actually started reading this then in the late 90s, early 2000s, because the movie was out well after I started. So, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, the first two books came out in 99, and the last one came out in 2006.
Wow, I didn't realize I was that close to... I remember waiting, because, you know, like people who read Harry Potter back in the day when it was coming out, you would go to Walmart at midnight or your favorite bookstore, hopefully, and go to the party, and it was this whole big thing, because you just wanted to know. And then I remember famously sitting in a bathtub, I think it was full of water at one point and then it drained as I was finishing like the fifth Harry Potter book or something. Same thing with these Lemony Snicket books, but to a lesser extent. Every time a new one came out, it was sort of an event and I would rush out to the bookstores because back then Amazon wasn't as big a thing and, you know, get the latest book. So, you know, and again, being a slightly older person, it was kind of weird going to the YA section, but again, it was, you know, it's a great series for kids and it's a great series for adults, I think, to enjoy with the kids, whether you're reading the books, which, again, if you want to get your kids interested in literature, another thing this series does is tons and tons of glorious references. I'm not going to go through all of them. There's a lot. But one, Vice Principal Nero, obviously from Roman mythology, or not mythology, Roman history, and playing a fiddle, of course, you know, the Caligari, which I can't remember what that reference is. It was like some kind of a horror, or maybe it was a Hammer film. I don't know. I got to dig up what reference that was. Gosh, I can't remember any of the other. Heimlich Hospital, that's kind of a more obvious one, right? The Heimlich Maneuver. Gosh, there's so many. All the characters, pretty much. Even the Baudelaires themselves. Baudelaire, it's been a while. I believe he was a French romantic writer. I used to know a lot more of this stuff, but when I was reading the books... and so, like, the kids' names have significance. Like, everybody in the story has, like, either a reference behind them that may or may not play into their character idea or something else. Like, it's a rich, rich tapestry. And again, the books are great, but the series that they've done, it's captured that tone.
So let's dig into that.
Yep, sorry. I obviously like this stuff and can talk all day.
I know, and that's why we're doing this. So, Netflix decided to produce this. Neil Patrick Harris is a major driving force behind the show. He is an executive producer on the show. He sings the theme song to the show. And he is one of the main characters as Count Olaf. So when Netflix announced that this was coming to their airwaves, what was your reaction? How did you feel? Because I want to say that around the time this was announced, we may have been in New York. Because I feel like I remember being on the train platform and you talking about it and kind of being excited for all this. So I feel like it was around a New York Comic Con-ish time.
A couple years ago then.
Yeah. So what was your reaction? How did you feel about it? What was going through your head when you heard that there was going to be a new series of unfortunate events?
I think when I first heard it was announced and Neil Patrick Harris was attached to it. Not that I don't love Neil Patrick Harris. I do. But I think because of you, I started watching How I Met Your Mother. Which is, you know, if not for Doogie Howser was his first, like, foray, How I Met Your Mother, the character Barney Stinson, is, like, the epitome of it's peak Neil Patrick Harris in a lot of ways, right? I mean, he's done a lot of other amazing projects. I don't want to diminish anything else, but, like, that show ran for so long, and his character was so vivid.
For 9 years.
Yeah, thank you. And, of course, you know that.
Well, in one of the most recent episodes at the end of season two, he makes Count Olaf makes a comment about trying to start a star in his own television show for 9 years or 9 seasons.
Totally didn't get that reference.
Yeah, that's I stopped for a second. I was like, wait a minute. 9 years of How I Met Your Mother. Yeah.
So I was a little worried because one of the problems I had with the movie, a very minor one, was that it was a Jim Carrey vehicle. And Olaf, when I was reading the books, was not someone I recognized, nor did he have maybe some of the more zany characteristics of the renditions. However, I thought Jim Carrey did a wonderful job in the end, in a lot of the scenes, conveying the menace that Olaf is supposed to convey. But what is interesting, because it was only the first three books, there's going to be slight spoilers throughout this, so I'll try not to do anything too crazy. But Olaf is a complex character. He's not just a mustache twirling villain it's sort of like a layers thing. As you peel away the layers of his character and you find more of his backstory, you realize that it's not just because he's evil. There's like reasons for why he's done what he's done. And the show is, again, kind of dolled that out in very small doses, but it gets you there certainly by the end, which is the last book, very creatively named, right? You get the full picture of who Olaf is in totality, and it's a complex character. It's one of the most probably complex villains in literature, if not certainly in YA, that I've read. You know, I mean, other villains, of course, whatever. And, you know, villains are should be more interesting than just mustache twirling, you know, ridiculousness. But Neil Patrick Harris, even though I was concerned when it was announced, when I found out the Handler was involved, who, again, like, it's his stuff, like, I was very excited. And then when I started seeing Sonnenfeld, when I started seeing more and more names attaching to this, and then the actors that they got. I mean, the kids are a huge part. I mean, they're the central point. Sonny, Violet, and Klaus, all, I mean, that is where most of the action is, these three orphans. And getting those characters right, I was really concerned that they weren't going to be able to capture the three that were in the movie, which were, again, fantastic. But they did in some ways. Now, I mean, this has supplanted my memory of the movie. So, yeah, as more and more stuff came out about the movie, and then we saw that first trailer. Oh, I mean, I just was delighted. You talked about Neil singing the opening. That opening song in some form is in the books. And so what I also love so far about the seeing the seasons is so many of the little touches in the book that you really can't bring to life without bringing it to life, like those songs. They're all there, and they're captured in really nice little moments. Even the opening, I was about to show you, I'm flipping through one of the books. Every book has a dedication to Beatrice, and they're basically presented, I believe, right out of the book at the beginning of each episode.
That's exactly the one that you're showing me. I remember that one word for word. That was what was typed across the screen. And I do love the dedications. That's actually one of my favorite parts for each. And it's at the beginning of each two-part.
Yes.
Because it's obviously the beginning of the book.
And I'm so glad they gave it two parts, because I could see them cramming a whole book into an episode. And it doesn't let it breathe.
Absolutely.
And I love that they gave it that time. And again, doing these as movies, I don't think you would have ever gotten as many character beats and subtleties and just delightful little moments that you get by letting it breathe as television.
Absolutely. And I do love the theme song, and I love that the theme song for every book is basically a synopsis of the plot, and that it's kind of gives you a little bit of a taste of what's to come without really giving too much away. And to your point with letting these beats happen, it's kind of funny as you get to the later episodes and the later books, they start to kind of tie in together.
Yep.
And you know, they obviously all tie together, but in watching the final two episodes of this season, actually the last one of the season, to start seeing the characters from all the other books in one place in that carnival, and seeing the angry villagers with the pitchforks, seeing the teachers from the preparatory school. Obviously Mr. Poe, the banker, is throughout the entire thing.
The nurses from the hospital.
You get to see these different characters who are basically contained in their own story, because the Baudelaires, you know, get into an unfortunate event in whatever circumstance they're in that book, and then they kind of disappear and go into a different thing. So to kind of get that visual callback and that visual tie at the end of the season, the second season, really kind of brings everything together, because you've gone through, you know, everything up to, you know, the first, what is it, nine books? I can't do math right now.
Yes, because there's 13 total.
Yeah. There's four more books left. So it's really kind of interesting to see that and have that visual tie and be able to see all of these threads really tying together nicely. So when the first season dropped, I know we mentioned this on a regular cast recording briefly. We never really kind of dug into it, which is why after seeing season two and now being nine books in and having 18 episodes to be able to watch, because if you want to binge watch them, all 18 episodes are available on Netflix.
I feel like we should have a sound effect.
This isn't the Joel McHale Show with Joel McHale. When season one aired, what was your thoughts? Like, when you finally got to sit down, and the trailer obviously got you really excited for this. When you got to sit down and we watched through this first season, how did this grab you?
I mean, it proved that they got it right. So again, watching the movie, reading the books, like they have a very similar sensibility, even the movie versions of those first three books. But as the show evolved past that, you got to the fourth book, which was the mill. I forgot the adjective for the mill. A miserable mill. I just saw it on my shelf. You started to now finally break away from what had been done before, and where I realized and really got impressed is as they started layering some of the music in, and that first season ends with this delightful song that I wish they put out on a soundtrack, and they have not yet. People listening, you should write Netflix and demand a soundtrack, especially for like the opening song and then that song. But it just tied everything together in such a delightful way that still fit the narrative, but, you know, kind of broke away because you had like Olaf singing and it makes sense, but whatever. It just put a nice bow around the first four books. And that's not something I was used to, because again, the movie did the first three. But overall, getting these different actors involved who have some notoriety. I mean, so Alfre Woodard, I think, was in the third one as the Guardian. So for those of you who don't know the formula.
Aunt Josephine.
Yeah, Aunt Josephine, thank you. For those of you who don't know the breakdown or how these sort of like episodic, you know, books work, Baudelaire's family die in a fire. They're the only survivors that we know of. They are passed from guardian to guardian.
They're entrusted to a bank.
Which, I know, makes no sense, right?
It really is kind of it starts off like wacky to begin with, where you have these three children who are orphaned by a fire that are then left to a banker to manage their guardianship.
I mean, he's a mulctuary manager. No, it's weird. It is an odd conceit, but the idea was, you know, their will, he's interpreting their will, and their will is like, okay, now you're going to go live with this person, and then you're going to live with this person, and you're going to live with this person. Only in that order, because unfortunately, again, series of unfortunate events, the guardians in question either meet with an unfortunate end or turn out to not be who they maybe represented they were, or X. I mean, there's a lot of different things that happen. What I like in the first season is you see after those first three books, like that pattern starts to break down a bit. And over the second season, you totally see that pattern degrade. So much so that there's almost a moment in the second season where the orphans sort of start to take on characteristics of the people pursuing them. So the orphans are on their own journey, not just to survive and find a home, but to start to unravel the mystery that is their family's legacy and this organization that sort of, it becomes one of the core mysteries of the series. And again, the movie barely got to touch on it. I think they had one little clue and one thing that was a spyglass and VFD and all that. But like, the books and the Netflix show have really gotten to explore that in a way that is really cool. And I'm hoping they continue to build with that in the third season when that comes out, I guess, next year.
So the first season for me was interesting. I mean, visually, it's a stunning show. The color.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
and the intensity and just kind of the, I don't want to say comicness of it all, but it is very just over the top and very visually appealing. It has a bit of a slow start. It really kind of does not grab you right away. It's a really kind of wild conceit. You have Klaus, who is introduced as basically kind of being the brains and has this like encyclopedic knowledge. You have Violet, who is a master of machinery, but usually only once she pulls her hair up into basically a ponytail with her ribbon. And then you have Sunny Baudelaire, who is the baby, who is like a beaver. She basically has these crazy teeth.
Very sharp teeth. I mean, yeah.
But not just sharp teeth, but a lot of times it's like crazy, like...
It's a cartoon, yeah. I mean, the books don't... So this is what's kind of interesting. And I will say, back to the topic of the first season, there are visual gags, and like you said, the visual style, that the only thing we had to draw on when we're reading these books is the original editions, and I don't know if they still do this, but I hope so. They have these beautiful... illustrations by I'm going to find his name, Brett Hellquist, and they're scattered throughout the book, so it's not like a graphic novel where you're reading a comic book. It's a true like classic style illustrated children's book, and so you know chapters will have like little. I'm showing Pat what this looks like. This chapter 4, and then at the bottom you have like caricatures of some of the people. In this case, it's the carnival. And you got the lions and you got all this stuff. So like, we only had this as a visual reference. And then of course our imagination, right? But seeing how they interpret it, like you said, it is a rich, luscious, gorgeous, very, Brian Fuller, Barry Sonnenfeld, very, very, stylized is the wrong word, but I mean, there's a bit of that.
I don't know. So I definitely would agree with it being stylized. It very much has a very specific style feel. It's that very lush, very colorful
or at times muted, depending on what they're going for. Because the other thing that's cool about these books in this series is they're not set in a certain time period. They're very much what does Glenn Weldon like to say about Guillermo del Toro? Fable. You can be whatever you want because it's a fable, and it's got a lot of that.
It's not as bad as Gotham, where you have flip phones and corded phones.
Well, Gotham is awful. So if you need more information about what Gotham is awful, just, you know, go back to any of our shows where we talk about Gotham.
It's oddly getting better.
Oh, I don't want to hear that.
Nah.
But yeah, no, they did a beautiful job. Season 1 really set a great tone. And every book has its own location. It does move around the world. So you get to really see varying styles from book to book to book, depending on where it's set.
Absolutely. So... Season 2 dropped on March 30th, and with it, it not only brought more episodes, because the way they've divided this is basically gone into a 4-8-4 type of breakdown, which works well, because when you have an odd number of books, you're not going to have an, you know...
4-5-4.
4-5-4.
Yeah. 8, because it's 2 episodes each, year, which surprised me, right? Remember, I was looking at the list, and I thought... Oh, wow, we're going to end on this book. And then I'm like, there's two more.
Exactly.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, so you had 4 books that were covered over season 1, and then the next 5 books encompass season 2. The one thing you can definitely tell from season 2 is that Netflix really was confident after season 1. They went ahead and greenlit seasons 2 and 3. So we'll be able to see all 13 books come to life on Netflix. But it definitely grew and blossomed into a bigger type of show with season 2, including new cast members Nathan Fillion.
Yay!
Joey Buchanan.
Who?
I know him from his days Firefly. On the soaps.
Oh, that's right. I always forget about that.
He was Joseph Buchanan on One Life to Live.
Oh, wow.
That was when Joey Buchanan wanted to prove he was an adult, so he started having a Mrs. Robinson-like affair with Dorian.
Wow. Yes, Did he have any of that swagger that he has now?
No.
I feel like it's something he grew into, and Firefly really helped with that, but Castle? What was his show?
He did
for like a million years. And
yeah, he did Castle. That was a thing.
I didn't like it, but...
I never watched it.
But no, Nathan Fillion's fabulous, and he plays a great character. And we're actually leaving out someone who...
She was going to be next.
Oh, no, not she. Ooh. Nope. we overlooked one of the more important parts of the show in season one and season two.
Okay.
So the books are very, like, they're narrated by Lemony Snicket. And one of my favorite actors of pretty much all time, from sort of that comedic, dry character actor, not character actor, just his persona is so, like, entrancing, I would say, is Patrick Warburton.
His chest hair is entrancing.
That too. But Patrick Warburton, who I always think back to Emperor's New Groove, Kronk, but of course Putty from Seinfeld. What else?
Excuse me. Spoon!
Exactly. The live-action Tick. Warburton has had a charmed career. And truly, that was one of the announcements they made back then. I was like, Patrick Warburton as Lemony Snicket? Like, it didn't fit the Jude Law, which was from the movie, like that British, very erudite sort of reporter, but very mysterious. But then that first episode in season one, we watched him and he came out and he did the whole narration sort of on top of the existing events, even though he's actually further in, like, the timeline, if you will, to, like, he's investigating the story of the Baudelaires. He's not interacting with it as much as recounting it. That whole narrative thing perfectly translated from the books, and Warburton sells it so incredibly well. But so, yes.
And it works. He does an amazing job with it. He is fantastic. And we need to get Patty Warbucks on the show. That would be a dream for me.
I mean, it would be an amazing interview. And from what the impression I've got, at least for Twitter and some other things, he's kind of a cool guy in his own right. He's kind of weird in a lot of cool ways.
His Twitter handle is Patty Warbucks. I mean, come on. But like, I mean, that's just awesome.
He seems to get attached to projects that are interesting to me, at least. And I feel like there's some, you know, reason for that. But yeah, his voice could charm the pants off anybody. Like,
absolutely.
He's fabulous. But Nathan Fillion was an amazing casting of his brother,
yes,
who I completely forgot is even in the books. Like, I have forgotten so much of this book series, which is kind of a great way to experience it, because you hate to be that person where you're like, well, that's different. Well, that's different. I don't like that. And I remember just enough to kind of go, oh, okay, I kind of remember this, and yet still be surprised. There have been moments where I'm like, oh my God, like Jacques Snicket summing up. And I'm like, oh, who is this guy? Holy crap. That's okay. But yeah, fabulous. And then next amazing.
They also added Sarah Rue to the cast, who comes in at season two in the first set of episodes as the librarian, and is kind of meek and mild and played in the background, but ends up becoming a huge part of season two and becomes a huge ally and friend for the Baudelaires. She is one of those actresses that you see her, and a lot of her roles that she's probably best known for are kind of weird or quirky.
What else has she done? I have no idea. I know I've seen her. I just don't know.
She
pops up, like you said, in random places. But seriously, I think she is one of the best librarian. So there's multiple characters in this book series and in the show that have libraries, because this little spoiler. The book advocates reading, and in fact, the Secret Order is sort of related to being erudite and, you know, well-read and all that stuff. But yeah, so she's one of the librarian sort of characters in this series, and she is spot on for it.
So she did Less Than Perfect, which was her sitcom. She was in Impastor, which was a TV Land original.
That's probably what I...
Yeah, I watched that on, I think, Hulu.
Yep, I remember
within the past
that.
Couple of years, yeah. And a bunch of different things. Eastwick, the Ring, Can't Hardly Wait. There's just a lot of things that she's done. But she's always that weird, quirky character. And it absolutely works brilliantly for her. She looks amazing. And when you get to a certain episode, she's in disguise. And quite honestly, it took... At first, I was like, is that her? But then I was like, no, that can't be. And then after being on screen a couple more times, it's like, oh no, that's definitely her, before they actually do the full reveal that it is her in disguise. And she definitely adds a huge element into the second season. It really did feel a lot more thought out.
Tied together the season in a good way.
Oh, for sure.
I don't remember I don't remember the books. I don't remember if that was her arc exactly in the book, though I did go back and verify if she is in that, the one where she's in disguise. But yeah, no, she's a great character, and yeah, that actress nailed that whole thing. The only thing that was kind of amusing at times is they did seem to kind of bustier her a little bit, a lot. Like her boobs were always like served up, which I'm fine with, but it was kind of funny each time you would see her, she would be in this very kind of, and it's not like overly sexualized, and it, I mean, it looked fine, but it was just a little like, okay, all right, Tits McGee, what's going on here? You know,
well,
just,
there's a lot of points throughout the show that are extremely adult sexual humor centric,
buried way subtext or presented visually.
Yes, because there was one point where Count Olaf was basically masturbating his hand or fisting his other hand.
Forgot about that. I was thought you were talking about the dancing. Lot of stuff with dancing and the metaphors of that and all that. Yeah.
Has anybody seen the boss's noodle? Like, you know, there's a lot of things that, and I'm sure that there are probably some kind of hints to that type of humor in the books a little bit, because I mean, they're YA, so you're not going to have that type of, it's like overt, you know, jokes. But would to call back to one of your comments from earlier, Handler being involved in writing this show is able to tweak it, make it a more modern telling of these stories, yeah. Add in these adult humor jokes, because a lot of the kids that have read these books already are now of that age where they're entering into adult humor territory. You can get away with the visual gags. You can do all these things that give it a different feel than books that are marketed to, you know, your 12 to 18 year olds.
No, I think you're right. I think there's definitely an element of, yeah, let's add additional humor for the adults, but really bury it deep so it's not like going to take you out of the story or kids going to ask weird questions. Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think, and Handler's other writing, it's not as young adult oriented. Basically, when he writes as Daniel Handler, he's a very satirical, very sometimes a little not sexual, but again, he has a sort of perverse sense of humor at times. So I can see that, you know, creeping in through his influence. But, you know, the stuff you're talking about is, like I said, very, very buried. And from the books themselves, like, and I was an adult, I mean, I was in my 20s, let's say, I didn't remember it being like too much, if any, of that. So I feel like that is more of, like they'll say, the later edition.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, that's basically like, I mean, you talk about Disney and Pixar movies that are, when they're family movies, you know, from a, you're going to have a portion of it that's going to be adult humor, because yeah, adults are going to be watching this as well.
Yep.
Whether it's the kids that have grown up from these books into adults.
Right.
Or you have an adult of, you know, 35, 40 years old that has a kid that they want to introduce this to, that they're going to be sitting there watching these episodes with it. So you get that little bit of extra humor.
And in the books, I will say, some of the stuff I was talking about, subverting the meaning of words, really is for the adults and the smart kids, because Handler wasn't just trying to, you know, he wanted to craft a book series that was sort of a kind of, I don't want to say gateway drug, but just it brought young readers into this world and educated them and kind of grew them up over time. And you, again, like I sort of alluded to this earlier, the Vile Village is a, actually, let's start with Ersatz Elevator, is sort of a satire of what's popular in culture, what's in and what's out. And that's a whole thing on that. The Vile Village is sort of a satire on government and the overregulation of this and that, and just society having too many rules. So a little more libertarian, I guess, philosophy. The hostile hospital is very much a satire of the ridiculousness that is a hospital, including the records and the
having to fill out forms in triplicate, quadruplicate, yep, and yep, all that.
And there was actually in the hostile hospital, there was actually some really delightful visual gags from The Shining that they added in. And that's certainly not something you'd, you know, read in the book, but it was really cool to see that brought out. The Carnivorous Carnival is less of a satire, more of like a freak show pastiche. I loved that in the background you saw one of the signs for a pinhead. So you're familiar with like American Horror Story or other freak show or carnival movies.
Which is a callback to Neil Patrick Harris's career, because he was in American Horror Story Freak Show.
I forgot all about that. Yeah, you're right. He was the magician, right? And then, of course, the Austere Academy.
Which he is a magician.
Right.
That's why magic is worked into just about every vehicle that he's in.
That's interesting.
Because even...
I didn't even remember. Yeah, okay, you're
as
right.
As Barney, he constantly was doing magic tricks in American Horror Story and in this. Now he's done magic.
I totally didn't think about that, but you're absolutely right. The Austere Academy, just to round it out, is, of course, a satire on higher education, or not even higher education, like schools in general, and some of the ridiculousness that kids experience when they're taking tests that they don't see any relevance to. But again, all couched in this world where the good guys read and are smart, or at least try to volunteer and help. And the bad guys are the ones that are really selfish, sort of like don't care about the facts, if you will. You know, like they're quite okay with the reality bending and telling whatever they need to get through life, and dressing up in disguises and all that stuff. So all of that is sort of sometimes a little more higher brow material that adults pick right up on. And again, the kids who are paying attention or maybe a little ahead of things also can enjoy as well. So,
absolutely. So I think season two, definitely a step up from season one. Not to say season one was bad at all, but it definitely gets that story going. Like you said, it dishes out more information about the mysteries of what's going on. It gives you, I don't want to say answers because we don't have 100% answers, but it gives you a lot more of where the story is heading and ties up some points and opens up new questions. And all of those episodes are up for streaming from season one and from season two. So season three was officially announced when they announced the pickup for season two. So we have four books left.
And they're thicker books. Each, like, it's kind of like, you know, Harry Potter as well. They got bigger as they went. So it wouldn't shock me if we actually got more than eight episodes in the last season. And then that's it. I don't think, really, there are prequel books and tie-ins and all that stuff, but I don't think their plan is probably right now, unless it does really well, to continue on or add new material. But those the end is like, I mean, it's like almost the size of two of these books. And I'll tell you, I'm not going to like spoil the ending of anything, but I will tell you this series does get darker as it goes through. And so as you go through season two and you get towards the end, it is kind of bleak in a lot of ways. The last four books are very bleak, and the last book's particularly kind of amazing to see if they can pull it off tonally and not just depress everybody. I mean, they tell you up front and repeatedly, this is not a story where people end up well, better off, you know, bad things happen to good people constantly. And this happens more in the last four. So
absolutely. I mean, that really is the theme that goes through it, where Lemony Snicket at the beginning of everything. And I love that he refers to them as episodes, because it's that like pseudo meta kind of feel to it. But yeah, it's very much, you know, if you don't want to see bad things happen, then turn away. Neil Patrick Harris sings it like 14 times in the opening song every
Look
episode.
Away. So, yep.
But no, when Neil Patrick Harris confirmed the renewal, he did say that season three was the end. So that will be the end of...
Which, logistically, you got these kids that are the actors. Like, you can't do much more than those three seasons, or they're going to turn into adults.
Well, and actually, they do make a joke about that, going from season one to season two, because at the end of season one, they're sitting on this bench, and season two picks up, and they're still sitting on that bench, and they didn't replace the baby. They kept the same baby, but a baby's going to have more of a growth spurt and more changes than a young adult would, and the baby went from being a baby to a toddler.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So they do make a joke about, we've been sitting here, it feels like we've been sitting here so long that Sonny doesn't look like a baby anymore. Like they joke about it and reference it. And I think that was a great way for them to really kind of do that.
Yeah. It's tongue in cheek. I mean, a lot of the shows were tongue in cheek, but that was a cute little meta humor like thing. Cause yeah, you're like, Sunny looks a lot taller now. But not like, I mean, she's still a baby or a toddler, I guess.
Well,
right?
Yeah, she went from looking more like an infant to looking more like a toddler, where instead of having to be picked up and carried everywhere,
she's more mobile.
She's walking a lot more. You know, they have her walking through a lot of these episodes. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see when they do production for season three and how that affects change with Sonny and with these actors in these roles. But that looks like it'll be a very interesting season. I'm excited. I actually, when we started this journey, I was kind of like, oh, okay, whatever. I'll watch these. It is what it is. And by the end of season one, I was like, okay, this is pretty interesting. Season two, from start to finish, I was very much enjoying every episode and really kind of looking forward to seeing, you know, and I'm getting invested in some of these characters, and it's horrible because any Moffat or Whedon or Martin story, you can't really get attached to anybody because lots of people die in these
and
episodes.
I forgot, because even at the beginning of season two, there's like a little reprieve from that. And so you really kind of just go, oh, okay, cool. And then something happens and you're like, oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
This is how the story goes. So
it'll be interesting to see how they wrap it up with season three, how these books translate into their episode counterparts, whether or not we have eight or more episodes for the final season. But no matter how it ends, I am sure that we'll be back to discuss season three. It's been a pleasure discussing seasons one and two with you, Brian.
Thank you.
And before we sign off for the night, if you're enjoying what we are doing, and it's a very different episode than we normally do, then please check us out online. Go to flameonshow.com. You can find all of our social media links there. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on Instagram, Tumblr, pretty much anywhere that there's social media, we are there. If you are interested in becoming a Patreon subscriber and helping support this show and the rest of the Nerdy Show Network, then visit patreon.com/nerdyshow. You can give one time, you can give monthly, whatever you can do. It helps keep us and all the other Nerdy Show shows going. And if you are so inclined, please do us a solid and head over to Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a star rating or write us a review. We love when you do that. That also helps other people find our show. And we can't do this without you. So keep on doing what you're doing, because you rock. And we'll be back in just a couple of weeks with our next full cast episode. We are quickly approaching episode number 200. If you have a question, a comment, a memory of Flame On that you want to share with us, send it on over to us. You can send it to pat@flameonshow.com. You can send it to brian@flameonshow.com. Leave us a message or a comment on Facebook, whatever it is, and you may be a part of our giant 200th episode. So with that, thank you, dear listeners, and we are out of here. Peace.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.